Hello and welcome to this podcast with your host, Paul Miller. Today I talk with David Siegel, author of a new book called Pool, The Power of the Semantic Web to Transform Your Business. We talk about some of the ideas that David explores in the book and compare them to other ideas of the semantic web. For more information on this show and others in the series, please see the show notes on the website. Thank you. David, thank you very much for joining me for this podcast today. Before we get into some of the detail around Pool and the semantic web, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself and your own background, please?
Sure, Paul. Thank you for having me on. I hope I can provide some insights to people. I've been in the web game since 93. I built my first website in very early 94. So I've been writing about the web since early 94, since I was a designer who transitioned early. So I might be the first blogger online, or at least one of the first couple of bloggers. I don't know of anyone who was writing sort of regularly before I was. And there were a bunch of us at the time kind of inventing all the hacks that we needed to make web pages do what we wanted rather than what the physicists wanted. So that led to writing my first book called Creating Killer Websites that came out in late 94. And then that was number one at Amazon for most of 95. So I had a web design firm in those days and was just part of the South Park gang in San Francisco trying to invent the web and help companies understand what websites were and what they should do about it. That led to a couple more books, Secrets of Successful Websites, about project management and dealing with insane clients and insane designers. And then I wrote a book called Futurize Your Enterprise in 1999 that kind of predicted the semantic web and how it would play out 10 years later. And now when I read back on it, it looks like sort of we're just getting started on that, but it's going that general direction. So I've been trying to write a book about the semantic web for real for about 10 years now, and finally got the chance to and spent the last 2 years of my life writing this book called Pool.
Okay, good. And it's Pool, The Power of the Semantic Web to Transform Your Business. So who's meant to read it? Is it for a web designer? Is it for a coder? Is it for a project manager, or is it for the chief executive of a Fortune 100?
It really falls between tech and business, and it's meant to bridge the gap so that technology people can use it to communicate with business people when they want to get their, you know, they have ideas for projects and they can see better ways of doing things. There's a whole new vocabulary in the semantic web, and I separate the two concepts, pull and the semantic web, which I want to get to in a second, But for managers, strategic planners, enterprise planners, investors, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, people who are looking for business opportunities, I think that's the main part of the market is people who are trying to find the business opportunities, the business case, the business drivers for implementing the semantic web. And I try to use the principles of pull to show why things are going to happen.
Okay, and throughout the book, you juxtapose this notion of push, which largely we have at the moment, with this idea of pool. Now, in a pool-based web, regardless of the acronyms like RDF and OWL and SCOS and all of those that we might get to, those aside, what is a pool-based web like, and why would I want one?
Great question. So, and it's not just the web, it could be the internet, because there are feeds of all kinds, whether they're on the web or not. Pulling information, I claim that we're in the middle of a huge shift. We spent the last 30 years digitizing information. We now have 500 exabytes of digitized information sitting around on hard disks around the world. We've digitized much of our information, and it's And we've, in large part, recreated our existing processes online. So if we were pushing products and pushing information and sending out brochures and creating ads to go to millions and millions of people, even though we knew only a few people would respond and so forth, that's what we've recreated online. And I think that we're going to spend the next 20 years making the shift from push to pull. And the easiest way to explain that is to look at media. Pull means getting what you want, when you want it, the way you want it. And the media industries are in the middle of this right now. There is no media executive who's not thinking about this. Customers want television, music, video, movies, when they want them, where they want them, the way they want them. And if you don't respond to that, you're simply dead. I mean, they're in the middle of this sort of death spiral of push right now in media. And places like YouTube and all the various places to get music streamed at you are MySpace, music streamed a billion songs in something like 5 days, I think, or 4 days. It took iTunes, I forget, close to a year to achieve that or something. I mean, it's just this huge disconnect between trying to recreate the old push model of here, we'll put our music up and then you buy it, you download it, you manage your music, to the pull model, which is it's always online. You stream it to yourself whenever you want. You stream it as many times as you like. You get it however, whenever you like it. You don't store it. You don't manage it. In fact, in the pull model, you don't manage your music at all. You manage your preferences. And preferences are metadata, and metadata has to be set up according to the way that we talk about in the semantic web to make it work. So pull is the what and the why. We're going to change from pushing to pulling in every single industry. It's not just for media. It's coming to your industry. If you can hear my voice right now, pull is coming. 10 years from now, it's very likely that the transformation will be mostly complete. And you're going to have to do it using a lot of the principles we have in the semantic web. So the semantic web is the how we're going to do it. But the business driver is that your customers want it. And it's a natural outgrowth of having instant access to all, you know, and having cheap availability of bandwidth and storage and clouds, like you talk about all the time.
So
cloud-based resources are going to be the availability of all that is what makes pull doable now.
If I'm an incumbent with a business model, with customers, with products, should I be scared or is this an opportunity?
I think if you're in media, you should be scared. That's pretty clear. Everyone already is. So rather than, if you look at their example, rather than waiting until it's too late, you should be proactive now and get started. Whatever your business is, I'm sure you have spent the last 20 years digitizing all your stuff. Now we have to make that digital information a lot more useful because however you've done it, you've managed to pretty much recreate your human-readable offline paper documents in digital form. So if you have a lot of PDFs and you're using Excel spreadsheets to do production work, I think you should be a little bit scared because we're going to use information very, very differently.
Okay, so it's about working the data that you have better to gain a competitive advantage.
Yes, although many industries will go all together because it turns out you have to do a lot of this stuff together, sort of in the same way that the web grew up. You know, the web gets its leverage when everybody is on it. Your switch from pushing to pulling will get more leverage when more people in your industry do it. So if you look at healthcare, for example, healthcare is solidly in the push category. The providers are in charge of the information. and they push information alongside the processes. It's pretty much an afterthought, and they use it, you know, around their processes, and you don't have much control of it as a user. But in the pull model, the user will have all his, or the patient will, everybody will have all his or her patient medical records and data right in one place, and then they'll give that access to whoever they want on an as-needed basis. But they'll be much more in charge of the process. And in fact, I claim that when the data inverts, the process inverts, so that the customer becomes much more in charge and drives. And that's not a bad thing. It's a very good thing. It's what customers naturally want. They want a lot more of your products or their services given to them their way. And this lets them do it. It's sort of the long, we've heard for many, many years about markets of one and custom virtual manufacturing, mass customization, and the semantic web, and it hasn't shown up. But now as we retool the data, we're going to finally have a chance to bring some of those things to fruition. So as you look at your data and how you serve information to customers, you automatically have to look at your processes and your business models.
So you mentioned media there at the beginning as one example of an industry that is kind of shifting to pool already. Are there other examples of industries that get it and are doing it?
Yeah, that's why I wrote my book. I want to talk about the semantic web acid test. I don't use the same definition of semantic web that many of the hardcore MIT people use. I use my definition is that if it's semantic, then it's unambiguous. So just whenever you hear the word semantic, think unambiguous. Just translate it word for word into unambiguous. And that means that if your information is unambiguous, then its meaning is clear both to people and to software. Software that finds it can understand what it means. And then if it's on the web, it's actually out on the web as opposed to in some database that has its own query language. So I mean, just from a business person's point of view, you can see that if you want to look for, say, if you want to buy a new car, you'd have to go to 20 or 30 different websites to go to each one and type in, you know, the kind of car you're looking for into its search engine for each website. And on the open web, if the information is really on the web, you ought to be able, if you're, say, looking for a silver Porsche Turbo with, you know, 30,000 kilometers to 30,000 to 70,000 kilometers on it with a red interior, you ought to see all of them show up on a map within a radius of, you know, however many miles or kilometers around you they are. They would show up because they're on the web. They're not buried inside of databases.
So there are plenty of big enterprises engaging in all sorts of semantic technology projects of various kinds. Do they pass this acid test of yours?
Yeah, I think they don't in general. A lot of these projects are trying to make sense of their large quantities of written information reports, and there's a tremendous amount of value in corporate knowledge repositories. But most of these projects are internal projects to do some kind of semantic analysis to their text and then build some kind of tools on top of that lets them, you know, mine their data better. So it's really a glorified form of data mining and a little bit of artificial intelligence. There's no sharing involved. And that's the important thing about the semantic web is that your data is on the web for other people, companies, groups to find and to work with, so that when we have a semantic web of data, we're able to mash up information to suit our purposes at the time. We can't predict what we're going to need in the future, but if the data is prepared properly in ways that other software can understand, then we'll be able to have a lot more flexibility in how we use it later, rather than having to retool and have data lenses and translate from one to another. So it's the translation that creates the Tower of Babel. It's theoretically possible to translate from one data representation to another, but it's practically difficult, too difficult when there are so many. So what we need are ways that companies can share information a lot more readily.
But surely if I'm a big enterprise, especially in the knowledge sector, that data is, it's my crown jewel. I don't want to let others use it and access it, do I?
That's a good question. Also, it's a good question at the personal level, but let's just take enterprise for a second. At sciencecommons.org, they're doing a fantastic project. Don't remember the name of it, but so, well, part of Science Commons is getting all these drug companies to hand over or to put their data into common formats and share common namespaces so that all researchers in the world can look up knowledge on a worldwide knowledge scale rather than within their companies. And that's so much more beneficial to drug companies to be able to see what everyone else has done rather than only what their researchers have done. So Science Commons gives a company the ability to put as much as they want of their information into a common format that's on the web, and then keep whatever they need, whatever they believe is, you know, absolutely proprietary, internal, and still they can see it all. So from their point of view, they can see everything outside plus their stuff inside, and every other company can do the same. But the more we have that's common, the more everyone benefits. And the drug companies realize this, and they're participating gladly. So that model could work for many, many industries.
Okay. And in describing the semantic web, you talked about the importance of unambiguity, which clearly sounds good and makes sense. You know, it's one thing to be unambiguous so that we both know I'm talking about London, Ontario, not London, England. That's
yes.
Okay. But once we begin to drill down in that, it actually becomes very quickly context dependent. You know, if you're in New York and
that's
I talk
true.
About London, London, England is good enough. but if you're in Wimbledon, you know, a suburb of London, England, for those who don't know, London isn't good enough anymore. And how do we begin to work with that?
Look, this is a difficult problem. And we have to be able to find machine understandable ways of representing our context. And it's not going to be easy, but my proposal is that we use these semantic web. The way we get away around the problem of too much information and sorting information is by adding more information. And so we can create contextual models that help us do just that. And I talk in my book about what I call the personal ontology. So just to give a clear example, your personal ontology will help you manage your music preferences and will know what kinds of music you like, even if you can't specify it by drilling down through menus yourself. Every time you listen to a piece of music and you like it, you just tell your ontology, I like this, and it'll start to use whatever metadata it can to start to arrange, to start to sort of design your music preference space. And it's all according to what you like. Everybody's tastes are different. But eventually, it's able to start predicting. And that's the power of putting the data in a format that you can use personally, but also can be shared with others. That when music is tagged by many people and then you use those tags, you can create your own context. So I guess what I'm suggesting is let's not create context by writing a lot of code and creating a lot of software programs that are context aware. Let's let the data do that and let our personal ontologies help.
Do we not then need to spend a lot of time coming to agreement? You know, are we not in danger of reinventing the scary big ontologies of the past where, you know, a committee gets together for a decade and comes up with a list of words?
Yeah, no, I think that's the power of adaptive software is that the software is very light and it builds the ontology as it goes. And every day the ontology changes. so that if whether it's my music taste or whether we are trying to find a location for a conference that we can all go to at the same time according to our schedules and so forth, it learns, it gathers new pieces of information every minute and stays up to date just by using what we normally throw away. Our normal data exhaust normally gets tossed, and instead of that we could use it and let the data drive our context rather than trying to build these big constructive ontologies and then release them.
Okay. And, you know, the technical underpinnings of this are clearly something that people have been working on for a long time. How closely is your vision tied to the notion of the semantic web stack from people like the World Wide Web Consortium?
My definition is bigger. The semantic web people are pretty invested in things like RDF and OWL, and they think that that ontologies are going to be the big, powerful thing of the future. And I agree. I think ontologies have a lot of progress, a lot of promise. But, you know, I was researching my book for the last 2 years, and I'm looking for commercial ontologies that are really out there earning their keep in corporations. And most of them are still in the labs and not doing that much commercial work yet. Now, there are a few, and there are some good examples, but they're just starting to emerge. So I really broadened my definition of things like linked data to just some XML schemas that are standard that people can share. For example, in financial reporting, XBRL is a format that's already really changing the way companies report data and the way governments receive information from companies. And it's being adopted by more than 90 countries worldwide and has been now mandated by many of the big stock markets, including the United States. So that's not an ontology. That is a taxonomy. It's fairly crude by semantic web standardista form, you know, standards. But it actually works, and it's doing billions of dollars. It's carrying billions of dollars worth of payload around the world, and it's going to be extended to helping with tax reporting and various kinds of compliance, even into the loan markets, banking, regulating all kinds of things, and also making our companies and our enterprises more transparent. And by aiding transparency, that will, I hope, help prevent the next economic crisis. So I think it's actually these little simple things can also be very powerful.
Indeed. And I spoke to Diane Mueller from the XBRL Consortium in one of these earlier podcasts, so people can go and listen to that for more. Yeah. And you have a section in the book as well.
I think it's linked data, and I think it's part of the semantic web, even though it doesn't pass the formal definition.
Okay. And you made a distinction there between taxonomy and ontology, which in a lot of conversations kind of get lumped together confusingly. How would you distinguish them?
Oh, a taxonomy is a tree structure that has information at the end, at the ends of the leaves. So, you know, sort of like our Dewey Decimal System for categorizing books. It's kind of poo-pooed by the ontology crowd, because an ontology is much more flexible. So if you have a taxonomy, you typically just have one way of looking at the world. There's kind of a root node, and then there's branches, and then there's leaves of the tree, and you can't really change that organization. And an ontology is much more flexible, where there's many different links between things, and it's more like there's no top. There's just links and groupings that anybody can make a new grouping or new associations. It's actually the right way to do things in many cases. And interestingly, about XBRL, they're now talking about the next generation of XBRL getting started on an ontology framework. So it's actually, you can migrate from a taxonomy to an ontology.
Okay. But in terms of, you know, a CEO who's listening to this from an organization that's thinking about the advantages of pool, you would suggest they don't necessarily need to be going out and buying all the books on RDF and OWL. They're useful and they're powerful, but they don't necessarily have to have them to achieve some of your vision.
I think every business needs to set up its information to be pulled. That does not mean you have to go off the deep end.
I think you can, for example, Amazon.com doesn't really have ontologies, but it sort of has quasi-ontologies in it. And if you search information and you find a product, you can find other related products that aren't necessarily in the same branch of a taxonomy. So it's kind of in the middle, but it works because they publish their API and a lot of people use it. So if you publish your data in a way other people can use, that's number one, the most important thing. Now, to me, the next thing on top of that is that you publish data in a way that everyone else publishes so that it's not you know, dictating the terms, but you're all in agreement. If you can reach an agreement with other people in your industry about what the formats are, and you publish them, I don't really care what the formats are. Putting them online is going to get you your information found, and then we can go from there.
Okay, and that sort of leads on to a lot of the scenarios in the book, which essentially talk about transparency in data, openness, sharing, publishing data so that people can take it and use it. They sound like sort of philosophical and business decisions rather than necessarily technological decisions. Would you agree?
Yeah, look at it's all more about your corporate culture than anything else. Look at Apple. Apple is a great example of a push company. Everything with Apple is proprietary, and you have to download your music and then hold on to your music and manage your music. And if you put your music on a couple of devices, but you can't put it on, can't have it on anybody else's device. So their corporate culture isn't open and doesn't allow for that kind of, you know, cloud-based innovation that they should. Look, in 10 years, Apple's going to have to stop designing beautiful personal widgets and start designing beautiful data centers and getting getting these personal data lockers and the personal ontologies and all this infrastructure set up so people can pull, because push isn't going to make it, and many, many corporate cultures are still based around push.
And is the sort of the social web, the web 2 web, is it not actually based around things like push as well? You know, specifications like pub sub hubbub are sort of the epitome of push, aren't they? So
yeah.
Are we paddling against the tide? Your arguments make business sense, but actually the world doing something else.
Oh, it's not coming my direction all at once? Oh, too bad. Too bad for me, I'd be a rich man. I think that Twitter and Facebook, both of which I've given serious analysis of on my blog at thepowerofpull.com, are very non-semantic. They don't pass the semantic web test at all. They're really push. So here's the problem. With Twitter, with Facebook, whenever I have something interesting to say, I say it. That's cool, but that's not when you need it. That's not what you need when you need it. So 6 months from now, you may find yourself, you know, having a particular problem and go, oh, I know somebody tweeted that, you know, some time ago, but it's in my brain. I can't possibly remember, and I don't have to look it up by keywords, and do I have the right hashtags, or maybe it was on Facebook, or could it have been on Buzz? I don't remember. Whereas all that information, if it were in a semantic format and it were set up out there in ways that you could find it, would let you then ask questions and pull it to you when you need it. So it's not on the publisher's terms anymore. It's on the consumer's terms. And I just think that even though at the moment we're in this, you know, bubble really of social networks, I think there's tremendous room for newcomers to come in and let people ask questions and get answers from their, you know, their trusted friends. I think that's really what's missing out there.
Okay, and an opportunity there for some startups perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's how Facebook and Twitter got started, and other companies will come along and do something similar. I just don't care when you publish something, because I need it when I need it, not when you tweeted it.
Mm, yeah, okay.
And so just making things findable and then being able to put one of the problems we're having is that coming up with a good interface. Suppose Google launched it tomorrow and said, hey, new, you could do a semantic search of the entire web. Well, how would you actually do that? How would you specify exactly what you're looking for? It's a difficult interface question. So people are working on that all over the place, and that's exciting.
And are you seeing any good early examples there? You know, what is the interface of the semantic web going to look like?
You see early examples in a couple of places. Good question. For example, if you go to a kayak.com and you say, I would like to go from New York to London, or a weather.com is another good example. What's the weather in London? Next thing it does is it asks you, well, which London did you mean? That is exactly the right part of the interface. You don't have to put up some big wall of semantic choices for people to get started. You can let them start with keywords. But then you have to ask them questions to help refine what they're really looking for rather than guess. And Google guesses. And in my experience, Google usually guesses wrong. But if you hunt around long enough, you'll find what you're looking for. But a good one will ask you questions. Wolfram Alpha, which you've probably even talked about, I imagine, is one of the first to kind of help you disambiguate some of your questions and find your way more easily to the exact thing you're looking for. Cool thing about Wolfram Alpha, which if people don't know is, what is it, wolfram.org, I think, yep. Or wolfram.com maybe now.
I'll include a link in the show notes. Presumably, with a lot of these examples you've been talking about, the cleanness, the value, the accuracy of the underlying metadata, however it's created, is actually pretty critical. And within, you know, a particular business environment, you can perhaps control that. But once we get out onto the open web, and once all these search engine optimizers work out that pool is the future, are they not going to start spamming it all? And we'll actually have more of a problem than we do now, because decisions are going to be made by systems on our behalf.
It's a really good question. It's clear that everyone games the system now, right? So that's what your SEO consultants do for you right now, is they figure out how to game the system, not to do what necessarily truly adds value, but what gets noticed by the search engines. And it's even more dangerous in healthcare, where I don't know how it is in England, but in the United States, certainly, we all have insurance codes. The doctors use insurance codes to say what's wrong with you and what procedures they're doing. And none of that information is right. They always mess around with the codes just to get paid exactly what they want to get paid, rather than perform the service that's in the code. So almost everyone's health records in the United States are already bogus. And that's a source of complete disaster here. Of course, people have actually been killed because of the wrong information in their health records. And then you talk about people willingly spamming just to get, you know, for commercial advantage. That absolutely will happen. But I'm not sure it will happen any worse than it's happening today. And your software will probably be better at finding the patterns and looking up who's causing problems a lot faster than we do on our own. So that's certainly not going to go away. But I actually think that the tools we come up with in the future for managing that will be more effective than what we have today.
They better be.
Yeah.
Because
it's a disaster.
Yeah. Especially as we begin to layer sort of inference on inference on inference.
Yeah,
and
sure.
You know, a stream of numbers, you're not going to know if the third number along is wrong, because it's just a stream of numbers.
On the other hand, think about who owns the information now. I am a lot more likely to be sure that my personal financial and medical records are right if I have them under my control on my personal data locker. I have a lot of incentive to do that. Whereas right now my health records and my financial records are scattered all over the place in different places where anybody with an entry-level job can make some kind of a mistake and not know that, that I don't have liver cancer, for example. So I think the ownership of the information will change, and when customers have more power, they'll have more vested interest in making sure their own information is correct.
Okay, that's a good point. So you're suggesting that if it's my medical record, I care more about it than a data entry clerk does?
Yeah, and we have that already in something called GDSM, which is a cool system for disseminating catalog information around the world that's tied to the UPC, the product codes, the barcodes. This it's called synchronization, metadata synchronization. When I update my catalog, that information goes immediately around the world to over 200 countries in exactly the same format that I just put it up in. So other people don't touch it along the way. It's not manhandled by other systems, and it's not translated into any other formats. And that's actually really helpful for keeping data clean.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So synchronization putting my information out in ways that it can just flow straight through rather than having to be translated
right.
is a big win.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Syndication.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. Package pooling. You talk a bit about, you know, packages and things like FedEx and UPS and the rest in the book. Is this the notion of package pooling, and how are you going to make it better?
Yeah, this is just a physical example of how you're just not just pulling metadata, but you can actually pull goods and services. And you asked about companies with private data versus opening their data. So in the United States, we have three big carriers, the Postal Service, UPS, and FedEx, that move packages around. And they all have their own internal codes and numbers and schemas and messaging, and particularly these, the package tracking numbers. So if I go to UPS, I get a UPS tracking number. And if I go to FedEx and send something, I get a FedEx tracking number. So that's great. They all have very elaborate computer systems. In fact, UPS spends more every year on technology than they do on trucks. But that means that they're not compatible at all. So it's great for the carrier like UPS that comes in and says, well, we've got the whole software solution for you and we'll even install it for you. But then you're locked in. So we have serious vendor lock-in here. And companies that ship a lot of packages have to choose one vendor, typically UPS or the post office or FedEx, to do pretty much all of their business with. Whereas if we had a standard, the public standard, like the universal product code, if we had a universal tracking number for packages, then I, as the shipper, could choose the carriers that I want to collaborate on getting a package from point A to point B. I might get it across the country with FedEx, and I might have it delivered locally by the Postal Service. That really is possible. We could pull packages to us if we had common standards, and those common standards were then native on all the carrier systems. In that case, in that scenario, I could just write paul@cloudofdata.com on a package and throw it into the mail stream, and it would interact with your travel schedule. You'd be notified of what it is and when it's coming. And you could even say, oh, actually, that doesn't go to me. That goes to my brother. You could forward it. Or I don't know if you have a brother, by the way, or somewhere. Or actually, no, I don't want that on the road. Send that to my home. There's someone expecting it. Or, oh, no, there won't be anybody at the office then. Send it across the street. You could pull it to you rather than rely on these big carriers with their, you know, the way they do it. We've all experienced it. They try to deliver it once. Oh, you're not there. They try a second time. Well, you just happen to be out that day, you know, and then they return it back, and then you have to call back and get it. There's billions and billions of dollars of wasted energy, at least in the United States.
Yep, and it's just the three different trucks that come in a day as well from the three different carriers. You know, I have days where everyone turns up at the door.
There you go. There you go. It's the same. Another good example is taxis. You know, the taxi that you call may be across town, whereas there could be one two blocks away that you didn't, you know, you just dialed the wrong number. Yeah. How do you know?
Yep.
Right. Why can't we collaborate? I think we'll all do better business and be more efficient. I think it's just more profitable for everyone. And so everyone should have a financial incentive to do it.
So why has no one done it?
It's hard. And they are doing it. As I say, that's what my book is about. That's why I wrote this book, to show who's doing it. And every day as I write my blog, I hear about more and more people really doing it. Museums cooperating. I just heard about the other day, Google Buzz getting more open than Facebook. Things are starting to crack, you know, and I think the old edifices are starting to show a little daylight where people can start to make progress.
Okay. Look, I look forward to seeing that. And yes, certainly there are plenty of examples of, you know, little glints of light and little success stories in the book.
And that's what you are doing, and that's what I'm doing. We all see this bright future, and we got to start somewhere. So
yes, we'll get there one day.
Yeah, sure. Or we'll never get there, but by trying, we make a lot of progress. And I'm really encouraged by the signs of progress that I see out there today.
Yeah. So you've applied some of these ideas to sort of physical things, you know, like the objects we were just talking about. We've applied them to more ephemeral things like my health record, in all the various places I might find it. How would you then turn it around and apply it to far fuzzier concepts? You know, I don't know, things like design.
Well, design, super fuzzy concepts are things like your preferences in movies and music. And I really do talk a lot about that with the personal ontology. But design is a very difficult problem that I'm trying to solve using the semantic web by laying out a roadmap to the design spaces of the future. And it's not so much fuzzy as it is hard, because they're in designing products, or let's just take architecture, for example. When you design a building, there are many, many people involved. And the traditional way we do architecture from the beginning of time is somebody scratches a little design on a piece of paper or something, and then that becomes a plan. And then you hand a lot of plans around for structural, for electrical, for plumbing. A lot of pieces of paper get generated. And everything's flat. And everything has to sort of come together in the minds of the architect. And that's why they go to school for 10 years, so they can put all these things together and catch mistakes. And then things start getting built according to these paper plans, and a lot of paper moves back and forth. And that's the way we're still mostly doing it today with our CAD systems. That's really the paradigm we still use today with our desktop systems. We design stuff on our own, and then we put it onto some repository, or we email it as an attachment and send it to someone. And then, you know, the more sophisticated ways of doing this involve version control and more secure transfer of documents. But still, it's documents. And what we're really trying to do is design a building. So this applies to product design, transportation design, even city planning. But let's just stick with a building for a second. If you can start with an online collaborative space that is, let's say, the footprint of where a building is supposed to go, and it includes the neighboring building and the information about the local building codes, weather, temperature, ground, you know, information about the solidity of the ground or earthquakes. All this information is already there. Then you could, and I just imagine doing this in a browser. Forget about your CAD software. Forget about all that heavy software that we have today. But just all these small pieces of software start, and different people start showing up to do their work. So some people start sketching. Some people start doing some plans, requirements. All this documentation gets written. And if it's all semantic, it all starts to fit together. And then the sketches turn into design. Then the design can be done. We can do what-if scenarios with the design. And we can include hundreds and hundreds of vendors in creating a virtual building before we build anything. So in this virtual building, you have lighting and flooring and wall coverings and furniture and appliances and furnaces and air conditioning and all this. All these things have to all fit together, and all of the subcontractors can submit their information semantically so that the whole thing really does get built in this collaborative design space. Then you can test it. You can send it out to bid. You can do lots of what-if comparisons. Once you finally decide what exactly you want and the client approves it, then that whole online space becomes the construction management space that the construction company can bring in their tools to do timelines, delivery schedules, placement of project stuff, limiting factor, gating factor stuff. What happens if something is late or something gets done wrong and has to be redone, and review schedules and approvals and all this stuff can be done so that as the building is built, this model kind of drives it almost in a virtual manufacturing way for building a single building. that what happens to the model happens to the real space. And also back and forth the other way. If something else needs to be done on the actual building, that can be reflected back on the design space or in the construction space. Then later that construction space turns into the marketing space for selling the business or its the building or its components or spaces or rentals or whatever. And then as people come take ownership or occupancy, then it becomes an operational space. So that one place is where all the data lives. The data never moves anywhere. We don't send anything anywhere. Instead, we have small programs and people coming in, specialists and different contributors and subcontractors coming in and plugging in and working on it with permissions and with revisions and with all the sort of things that you might really want to do. So you build a building in 3D and you say, wow, that sounds different. And is anybody doing that? Yes. About 4 buildings in the world right now are currently being constructed using 3D models and no blueprints. It's pretty exciting. It's called BIM, the Building Information Model language. And it's just getting started, and the software doesn't exist for it. But people are out there trying it, and it's sort of just coming out of the labs and starting to make its way into commercial use. And that collaborative design space approach could be used for everything. And in fact, already is being used in a private way by Dassault Systèmes and Boeing. They haven't designed an airplane using schematics and drawings for 20 years now. So starting in the early 1990s, Boeing has been doing exactly this, building a virtual plane, in fact, even test flying it. They've built in the 787, which is an airplane that will be released later this year. They built the entire plane virtually. Then they built a simulator for it, so they simulated the cockpit. And then they brought in pilots to fly the virtual plane, and they made quite a few changes to the design of the plane based on how it handled in the simulator. So they're not going back. They're building airplanes in 3D in the same space with 20,000+ contributors and subcontractors all in the same space. What we need to do is open that model up so that anyone can design anything that way without having to have millions of dollars worth of software. That's the future I envision.
And all of this, of course, requires those unambiguous identifiers that we were talking about right back at the start, so that you and I both know we're talking about the same chair for the office.
So that your pinion bearing fits on the wheel that goes onto the assembly, that goes into the landing gear, that can retract into the housing, and it can all be tested and worked and find out that you need a little more lubrication before you can start manufacturing these bearings.
Yeah, yes, indeed. So, you know, the earlier examples we were talking about were almost little islands of shared content and shared understanding that got richer and richer, but remain sort of a subset of the universe that we live in. What you're talking about there is almost beginning to suggest that these little islands all need to join up. So are we looking at a single sort of pool web? Or is it okay to have these little islands continue for a long time to come?
Well, the design example is very similar to the Science Commons, and they're doing this Neuro Commons project so people be able to design proteins collaboratively. It's exactly the same thing as the design space. It's very hard to design proteins because they fold, and there are millions of ways that a single protein can fold. So you need a lot of resources, and it's much better to share. So the more we can put out in the public spaces and the more that the data sort of stays at the center, then we can innovate by making lots of little programs that come run around and come in and go out of existence and get called and used as needed. So the ad hoc nature of it, that if we're in the middle of a huge design project and the data is there and we need a new tool that no one has, it's not that hard to build. The ad hoc nature of putting databases together on the fly is what's going to be the big sort of a killer app here and the reason for everybody to share. And so I think a lot will be more and more common. And you'll see that, for example, a wine industry ontology or workspace starts to connect over to a spirits and alcohol, which connects to champagne, which then connects to where am I going? To party supplies, to rentals, party space rentals. I mean, all these things can be connected so that you have all the resources together to put together your New Year's Eve party, and everything really can come together on, you know, as you need it.
And back through then to a tourist site for the Napa Valley, so you can go and see the vineyard. You've painted quite a broad picture here of various ways that pool and a sort of pool-based web begins to influence different parts of the market. So I just want to finish off by asking you about sort of three different perspectives on what a potential listener should do about it. And the first of those, I'm a chief executive in an existing company. I'm wondering where to go next. I'm coming out of a recession. I want to start doing something to push me ahead of those around me. I've read Pool. What do I do now?
There's so much to do. First of all, if you're at a decent-sized company, you're spending 80% of your IT budget patching and fixing and keeping your existing software working. That leaves 20% for innovation. If that's acceptable to you, then I don't think you're going to make it in the 21st century. I think the first thing you need to do is change your corporate culture to get people to start to embrace openness and sharing, and get together with some of your competitors and start to say, how can we all do better for our customers? That this is going to be a customer-led revolution. Customers are going to demand more and more. If you think we're going to go back to the old days of programming television programs, you know, coming on at 8 o'clock at night and you have to be sitting at home in the living room to watch it, you don't get it. You've got to realize that this is going to go more and more and more in the direction of the customer. And what do they really naturally want? So pull is a natural force. You have to go with it, and you have to ask, how can we make things very different? So one great example in IT is you've got to go from a rigid procedure-based framework to more of a data-driven adaptive framework. You can start to learn about adaptive software. There are dozens and dozens of books about it. People like Paul Miller will be happy to tell you more about how to make your systems more adaptive. That kind of thing, and making our back-end systems much more flexible and the systems that follow our processes much more flexible is a really good place to start.
Okay. And if I'm a venture capitalist with a load of dollars burning a hole in my pocket, where should I be putting them?
Too many venture capitalists are doing semantic projects that don't connect to the rest of the world. So I would say stop investing in one-off things that are semantic but are inside the enterprise, and start creating whole ecosystems that anybody can tie into. So break it into much smaller chunks and find small innovations that are going to enable big changes in industries rather than replace some big artificial intelligence project with another, you know, more semantic project that doesn't necessarily scale up. Scaling up is really the big question, and I'm going to release a video about that in a couple of weeks, about how scale really changes the game. And if your semantic solution isn't going to scale to web-wide, then it's not worth investing in.
Yeah, okay. And the third one then, I'm just out of college. I can't invent Google because it's been done. I can't invent Facebook because it's been done.
Right.
What should I do?
I'll start. You know, one of the quotes on the back of my book is that there are 10 killer business plans in my book, and I really believe there are so many great opportunities for startups out there. You do have to show a little traction, get a little funding, but you've already interviewed Martin Hepp with his exciting Good Relations Ontology. Think little projects like this that could really scale up to be huge. If you're just looking for opportunities, you might bolt something on top of that, or bolt something to other things that people are building that are scalable. That's the great thing about scalable systems. Like, you know, if we had the design world that I just talked about, especially for things like film production, anyone could then sit down and program up an actor to go modularly into a collaborative film design space, and that actor would immediately know what to do and how to work with the other actors. So anyone can be an entrepreneur when we have web-wide distribution that all plugs and plays rather than lots and lots of different competing formats that's difficult to, that the distribution is the bottleneck for.
Okay, good.
Also, one thing I just wanted to mention is that everyone can start doing, and that's power tagging. So we have a lot of tagging going on these days, and it's very ad hoc. If you look at the Twitter hashtags, they practically mean nothing. I mean, it's very hard to get concepts centered around a certain hashtag. It's more like a dozen or dozens of hashtags that come around a certain concept. So if we can find ways to tag as we go at the time, for example, giving reviews and ratings and things. If you stay in a hotel, you want to be able to give a review of the hotel as you stay there. You always think, oh, well, I'll maybe write something up, or I'll write to that guidebook and say that the hotel wasn't as good as they said. But you never do it later. You need to do it right at the time. And I think a lot of people who are thinking about systems or making things better could think about how can we enable people to add their metadata or add their annotations and reviews and information right at the time of use rather than later. So we get to more of a real-time economy. Any little program or product that helps with that, I think, will be taken up. And it's another great place to start innovating.
Okay, good. So I hope some startup builders are listening in. So we've covered a lot of ground there. We've also had some technical problems that mean we can't always remember what we said in the previous segment. Hopefully someone listening won't know that. Have you got any sort of closing thoughts? Anything I should have asked you and didn't?
Just the main thing that people have to ask themselves is, how do we set up to pull? This is what your customers want. Do we not just pulling information, but actually pulling products through the supply chain, pulling services through the service supply chain? How can we set up to pull? I'd really recommend that people sit down with their colleagues and have a meeting and ask that question. How can we set up to pull? And what do our customers want to pull that we're not listening to, and we can't feel the tug yet?
Okay. Good advice. And thank you very much for your time, David. It was interesting talking to you and interesting reading the book as well. And good luck with making some of these ideas come to fruition.
Thank you, Paul. You're doing great work, and more power to all the people out there trying.
Okay. Thanks a lot, David. Speak to you soon. Goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.